One of my suggestions to our producers, whether these are large ruminant producers like dairy cattle producers or beef cattle or sheep and goat producers, is to analyze your forage quality because we can never go by book values. Book values can be deceptive. If the growing environmental conditions change, the forage quality changes. And if we do not analyze our forages, we don't know what kind of nutrients we are feeding to our livestock.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Kemin invites you to optimize animal feed quality and safety with our portfolio of solutions. Learn more at kemin.com/AG. Evonik, we are sciencing the global food challenge.
Welcome to the Feed Science Podcast, coming to you from North Carolina State University. I am Adam Fahrenholz. I'm an associate professor here in the Prestige Department of Poultry Science and in the coordinator of the Animal Food Manufacturing Program. On behalf of Wise Genetics, I'm excited to introduce our guest today. Our guest is an associate professor in the Department of Animal Science at the University of Florida. This is Dr. DeWalker Vias. DeWalker, nice to have you with us today.
Thank you very much, Adam. Thanks for having me on the podcast. I appreciate it.
Yeah, we're glad to have you. So I know your background and a lot of your work is in the ruminant space, and we're going to talk some today about fiber digestibility. But before we get into that, if you wouldn't mind, give the audience a bit of your background and then what it is that you work on there at Florida.
Sounds great. My background is I started working on the animal sciences as a part of my DVM degree back home. I'm originally from India. So I finished my DVM and I did my master's at the National Dairy Research Institute, again in India, where I started focusing more on my research projects using some of the strategies where we work on fibrolytic enzymes and applications were dairy cattle. So it was, the thesis was more focused on dairy cattle nutrition. And then for my PhD, I came to University of Maryland, and I continued working on dairy cattle nutrition area. And specifically, I was working on mammary lipid metabolism and how it changes milk fat synthesis in dairy cows. So after I finished my PhD at the University of Maryland, I went to Canada, worked for Agriculture and Agri-Food Canada in a place called Lethbridge. It's Lethbridge Research and Development Center. And there, my work was more focused on environmental sustainability in the beef cattle production systems, where I was involved in a lot of projects that were focused on methane mitigation and how we can improve the feed efficiency and performance of both backgrounding as well as finishing feedlot animals. Some of my projects were also focused on animal health, how we can reduce the incidence of ruminant acidosis, especially in grain-fed beef cattle. So, after I finished my postdoc in Lethbridge, fortunately, I got an opportunity to start my faculty career at the University of Florida in Animal Sciences Department. And because my background was on ruminant nutrition, that's what the focus of my program has been since 2016. So the major part of my research career has been focused on large ruminant nutrition, working both with dairy cattle as well as beef cattle nutrition. Again, very similar to the background I had earlier. But over time, I also got more interested into forage conservation and silage making. And what are the strategies that we can use to improve the quality of the silage, how we can improve the fermentation efficiency, how we can maintain and preserve the quality of the forages before and after ensiling. And some of the projects that I have now are focused on small ruminants, like working on sheep and goat, because we realized in Florida that there are a lot of small ruminant producers are very excited about sheep and goat, and they really need a lot of inputs. So our stakeholders need a lot of research-based inputs, extension-based inputs. So that is another part of my research program where I work on some of the very applied nutritional strategies to improve the performance of our sheep and goat and very pertinent to our stakeholders. Along with research program, I have 70% of my commitment is research and 30% is teaching. I teach one undergraduate course every year. It is focused on food, animal nutrition and feeding, where I cover swine nutrition, dairy and beef cattle nutrition. And every other year, I have a graduate level course on forage quality evaluation. So Yeah, it's been, now 8 years. It's going like that. So yeah, time flies.
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. Well, there's a lot of interesting things there. And I think we could talk about quite a bit for quite a while. But I guess, so some of the things that stand out to me when you talk about that is you kind of have an interesting, how would I say this? An environment in which you're working, in which you get to talk some about animal nutrition. You're talking, like you said, about forage quality. I'm guessing that also comes in. You mentioned conservation and natural resources and things like that. So when you are doing your research or you're working with producers, and you mentioned there's a lot of like small ruminant producers, what are some of the things that are the most important things that they need to be looking at when they are selecting a forage, or whether that be pasture or whether that be things for silage? What are the things that are kind of paramount to their success when we're talking about something like forage quality, the fiber quality that's in the forage, all those sorts of things?
Yeah, that's a very important question, Adam. And Florida is great, right? I mean, we don't have very severe cold, and our hot and humid weather is very well known across the world. The problem with this kind of weather is that our forage quality is always compromised. When we look at some of the forages that we feed our dairy cattle, then the quality is low on the lower side when we compare with the forages that are grown in Midwest or Northeast. And the major factor that reduces that quality is the digestibility of the fiber, and in some cases our starch digestibility as well for the forage crop that we have grown here. But I think the major bottleneck is the fiber digestibility, because based on some of the very recent feed quality analysis that we have received at our dairy unit, the fiber digestibility is very similar to the lowest standard that we have for the corn silage. And again, you just name the forage and then fiber digestibility will be an issue. Probably I'm not an agronomist. I'm trained in a nutrition background, but again, maybe this hot and humid climate favors more indigestible fiber deposition when the plants are growing, right? So one of my suggestions to our producers, whether these are large ruminant producers like dairy cattle producers or beef cattle or sheep and goat producers, is to analyze your forage quality, because we can never go by book values. Book values can be deceptive. If the growing environmental conditions change, the forage quality changes. And if we do not analyze our forages, we don't know what kind of nutrients we are feeding to our livestock. So that is the first point that we have to consider for the producers. Even for the researchers, we need to know what exactly we are feeding. But in the case of research settings, yes, we do analyze our forages before they go for experimental trials. But this is my biggest recommendation for producers. Send your forages for lab analysis. Get to know what levels of nutrients they are providing. Get to know what kind of digestibility these nutrients are providing. And then they really understand like how these forages can now be used for supporting the performance of these animals, whether improving milk yield, whether average daily gain in the case of beef cattle, whether the animal health from sheep and goat perspective. So that is the first point that I always would like producers to have it. I think the other point is for our dairy producers, we have a corn silage hybrid program that University of Florida and University of Georgia is running from, I think, more than 20 years. And what we do is that we take seeds from our industry stakeholders, and then we grow these seeds on our experimental plots. And we look at a lot of different parameters. We look at the biomass potential, we look at the nutritive value, disease tolerance, digestibility parameters, and then we provide all of these results on a web page for our producers to look at.
Okay, cool.
So we do that for spring, we do that for summer. And I think that's another take home for our producers here is that, they are interested in forages like, sorghum or sorghum Sudan or corn. Please have a look at some of these outputs that we are providing every year so that they know what are the best varieties they have in the region.
Mm-hmm.
And they can select these varieties based on the fiber digestibility or starch digestibility or biomass potential or disease tolerance, whatever their parameters of importance are. And so that really sets them apart for success. I think this is very important for producers, especially in this region where, you know, growing conditions can have so much impact on a lot of different parameters of the forages.
So I know when we're in the Midwest, upper Midwest, we see on the silage side, we see a lot of corn silage. We can see a few others as well. And it sounds like you're also saying corn silage there. We also will obviously see like high quality alfalfas and things. Where you're at and the producers in Florida, what are their options for the silage and for the forage there? I'm not familiar with what the specific options would actually be.
No, that's a great question, Adam. For our dairy producers, still corn silage is the biggest thing, right? I mean, because the fiber is digestible, there's a lot of starch present in corn silage, and that really supports high energy requirement for our high producing dairy cows. So corn silage is still the most abundantly used forages for our dairy cattle production systems. When you talk about the beef production systems, most of the state of Florida is cow-calf operations. We don't have a lot of feedlots here. And these cow-calf operations are mostly on grazing systems, right? So these are the pastures that are either native grasses or developed pastures. And mostly these are tropical grasses like Bermuda grasses or Bahia grasses. These are some of the improved varieties that we have. And thanks to our agronomists on plant breeders, they keep on working towards coming up with new varieties of some of these tropical grasses and making sure that the biomass potential is increased and the digestibility of nutrients is increased. So that is another source. So tropical grasses like Bermuda, Bahia. I know limpo grass is also very common in South Florida, where they are using that for grazing the cow-calf operations. We don't have a lot of alfalfa because, there's a lot of research going on in coming up with varieties that will thrive here in this hot and humid climate. But we still, compared to the Northeast and the Midwest, we don't have a lot of alfalfa grown here. There are some clovers, mostly, I think our beef producers are reliant on the tropical grasses and our dairy producers on corn silage. At our dairy unit, we have tried oat silage and ryegrass silage as well. Ryegrass silage was tried 1 year, and then we moved back to the oat silage. So oat silage is very common every year now. So major chunk of our forages for dairy production systems is corn, and then a little bit of that is oat silage.
Again, my guest today is an associate professor in the Department of Animal Science at University of Florida, Dr. DeWalker Vias. So I think that's one of the things that's really interesting. And it makes, I spend a lot of time in the poultry and in the swine world. But of course, we're importing from wherever we need to, whether it be other parts of the country or even other, might be coming out of South America. They're bringing through the ports is the easiest way. We're bringing corn. And corn's going to change from a little bit here and there. But for the most part, a lot of the nutrition work, let's say, that's done in some other part of the country on swine or poultry can probably be translated into nutrition work that is done in another part of the country. Now, there's going to be some co-products that we use in one part that we don't use the other part, that sort of thing. But I think it's really interesting part of like your work and really ruminants kind of across the world is that, okay, if a major part of, let's say, dairy research is happening in the Northeast of the United States, okay, well, that's great, except for what they're going to have access to there is not the same thing that you have access to in Florida, and certainly not what we see elsewhere around the world, right? And they eat so much that it's not, we're not shipping grasses on ships across the world like that. So, I'm curious with that having, just as you were talking about some of the different things you were doing, what does that look like for other parts of the world, other parts of the U.S. as far as how far are we willing to go to get to import, export, to move high quality forages versus looking at you know, we just have to deal with what we have. What does that look like in the ruminant world?
Adam, I think this is a difficult question, right? It's not an easy response to that. What we have found is, you know, when we talk about sustainability, like, there are different pillars of sustainability, right? Environmental sustainability or economic or social sustainability. When we focus on the economic sustainability aspect, I think it favors more towards consuming what is produced locally. Yeah, because again, let's take an example of feedlot. We don't have a lot of feedlot in Florida because probably the feed ingredients that we need for growing feedlot, I mean, we need to import that, and it is not very cost effective. And that's why it makes much more sense, you know, to send calves, backgrounded calves outside to finish, where it is much more cheaper to feed and to raise feedlot animals. So I am more inclined towards using feed ingredients that we produce locally. That helps in that economical sustainability aspect of the livestock production, which I think in today's environment is very, very important, because we are looking at income or feed cost at the end of the day, right? And I mean, that income or feed cost will always favor something that you don't have to transport for a very long distance. Let's take an example of alfalfa. It's a great resource. It's a great forage. Alfalfa hay is a great forage for dairy production systems. But we don't use that at our dairy unit because, I mean, this is expensive to import alfalfa hay. And maybe the milk that we are producing, it will not break even. I mean, you know, a lot of these things that we have to take into account. Some of the byproducts that we use here, like citrus pulp, it's you know, coming from orange industry. Florida, I mean, a few years back was the topmost citrus or orange producers in the country. Unfortunately, because of the greening disease, we are losing a lot of it. But again, citrus pulp was the byproduct of this orange industry, and then we were using almost in every dairy cattle diet citrus pulp. We still try to use that because it is locally available. But now we are replacing one by one, one-on-one, like with soy hulls. Soy hulls are similar kind of byproducts that we can get easily available in Florida, and then we can use that in the diet. So when, like, based on my experience, and again, I have to be very cautious, right? Because it's just, you know, a few years of experience compared to people who are in industry for so many decades. To me, I think something that we can make use of what is available locally goes a long way in terms of sustainability. So that's what I would prefer responding to the question. And again, not an easy question to answer.
No, and I think we've seen that, right, where there are areas where, you know, there maybe the expenses is warranted for a very particular, you know, high margin beef or dairy type to do it, but otherwise it's not. You know, as I was thinking, as mentioned, citrus pulp in the feed industry, in the compound feed industry, we obviously have tons of different ingredients that we use. And, you know, most of them are fine. There are a few that are a little unpleasant to work with. Citrus pulp is right up there with, like, bakery meal for me, of like, oh yes, when we can use that, like, there's nothing like that coming in. Every once in a while, we'll do a trial here or something, and we'll use citrus pulp pellets and come in, and that's a whole different smell in the mill, which is really nice. I think you already mentioned, and this is kind of the road I was going down. You already mentioned that probably the most important thing, when you can't just have any forage that you want, the most important thing that you need to do is make sure that the forage that you do have access to, you're getting it analyzed. You know what you're feeding, and then you can, you know, adopt your strategies from there. So I guess the kind of the last question I'll ask in kind of our main part of our conversation here is, what then are those strategies that people will use? Are there things that people will do from a management perspective, an additive perspective, to say, okay, I may not have the best quality forage available to me, but I do know what I have because I've analyzed it like you suggested. Now, what do I do? Now that I know that this is what I've got to work with, what are my options as a producer once I get to that point?
Yeah, no, thanks for this question, Adam. I will try to list, because of the time constraints, I think we cannot go into a lot of details, but I'll try to list some of the management practices that we can use to improve the fiber degradability, at least focusing on that. So definitely variety selection under growing conditions. That's a very important part, because, you know, if you are interested in improving fiber digestibility, maybe you can select for those varieties that are very ideal for your growing conditions. And the hybrid programs that we have in Florida or Wisconsin or New York, producers in those areas should look at those hybrid programs and look at what varieties are more optimal. Second point that I heard from our field experts, like Dr. Bill Mahana, he always says that, you know, late season plant health is very important for maintaining that fiber digestibility. If the plant health is optimal, the fiber digestibility is optimal. But if the plant, for some reason, the plant health is compromised right at the time of harvest, it does significantly influence fiber digestibility. So again, that's another take home for our producers. Just make sure that, you know, the nutrient management, the irrigation management, whatever we can do to maintain that plant health, really is taken care of, just to improve that nutrient digestibility. The other point which I would like to mention is, once if you are making a silage, make sure that the silage that you're feeding to our cattle is not spoiled. Because sometimes if we do not pay attention and we add that spoiled silage into the bunk, into the TMR, into the total mix ration, then it reduces the nutrient digestibility and nutrient availability to our dairy cows. And there's a lot of research data that have shown that if you add more and more spoiled silage into the diet, it reduces the fiber digestibility. So again, that is one thing that our producers can pay attention to. Let's reduce that proportion. Additives, as you mentioned, Adam, additives are also very important. That maintains the quality of the forages. Like when we are preserving forages, it is very common to add inoculants, like microbial inoculants.
Sure.
And you know, the type of inoculants, what is your objective? If you want to improve the fermentation efficiency, definitely homofermentative bacterial inoculants, Lactobacillus plantarum, and bacteria that favor that production of lactic acid can be added. If our objective is to add more shelf life to forages once the bunker silo is open, we can add heterofermentative lactic acid bacteria. Or nowadays we have commercial products that include both kind of bacteria.
Okay.
Homo and heterofermentative. So that not only improves lactic acid concentration, but also increases acetic acid. And that helps in increasing the shelf life of the preserved forages. So this is what you can do before, you know, the forage is being fed to animals. These are some of the strategies that I mentioned. But once the forages are in the diet, we also have some strategies that we can use to optimize the nutrient digestibility, the fiber digestibility in this instance. Like, for example, we can use we can optimize the particle size.
Okay, sure. Yep.
So, you know, if you chop to a guidelines, based on the guidelines, then definitely it helps in not only optimizing the chewing time or eating time, have more rest time, but also we can see that in the terms of fiber digestibility and the performance. There has been new data that comes out that, you know, the kind of minerals that we are using in the diet, trace minerals, are much more favorable to the rumen health and improving fiber digestibility in the rumen as compared to other sources like sulfate sources of trace minerals. So at different points, we have different strategies that we can use to optimize that fiber digestibility.
Gotcha. Okay. So to kind of summarize that, it's you know, you may not have, if you're a ruminant feeder, you may not have access to like the best forage in the world. That just may not be, and it may not be economically feasible. As you mentioned, it may not be sustainable, socially sustainable, economically sustainable, environmentally sustainable, whatever. But if you know what you have, which means you have to analyze it, and then you actually learn and teach yourself about all these different various strategies, things you can do to the forage before it's being fed, things that you can do during the feeding process, there's actually quite a bit that can be done in order to get the most out of those forages. Even if they're not the most ideal, you can get that fiber digestibility that you want if you know what those strategies are.
And, you know, kudos to our livestock producers in the state of Florida. Despite of so many challenges, they make their businesses thrive. They make sure that, you know, livestock production is thriving. Despite of all the challenges that we have, the reduced forage quality and everything. And they know how to manage them. And it's just they learn from their experiences.
Yeah, that's right. Absolutely. Yeah, everybody figures out their own way to do it.
It's time for our famous three.
Evonik Animal Nutrition is committed to ensure food security and safety while reducing the ecological footprint of animal farming. Its products and services use evidence-based solutions that seek to promote animal welfare and reduce reliance on natural resources. All this is underpinned by long-standing industry partnerships and deep customer understanding. Evonik's focus on efficiency, sustainable, healthy nutrition, and collaborations with livestock farming partners creates value for customers and consumers.
All right. Well, that was a great conversation. I really appreciate it. We always like to finish up or sometimes like to finish up on the podcast. Depends on the conversation we're having. With just some overall questions based on your experience of dealing with folks. And whenever I'm talking to somebody in academia, I'd like to talk about things that relate to students and resources. I always find interesting. So the first question I was going to ask you is, and it's kind of a two-part question. We know that we do have graduate students that like to listen to this and the other Wisenetics podcasts that are out there. So kind of two parts. What is it that you find when you're working with students, undergrads and graduate students, that makes for the best students? What are the kind of things you see in those students that really makes them stand apart? And then also, when those students are thinking about the next step in their careers, when they're ready to go out into the industry, out into the workforce, what are the kind of things that you advise they need to be aware of that is, you know, maybe a little different than what school was while they were there?
Adam, as I mentioned earlier, I have a research in the teaching appointment, right? So I do interact with undergraduate students as an instructor of one of the course of food, animal nutrition and feeding. And my graduate students, definitely, I teach, and also they are in my lab as master's students and the PhD students. In a nutshell, I'm very excited about our future, especially looking at these students, you know. All the undergrads and grads that we have in the department, they are passionate. They really would like to work in animal sciences, and that's why they are here. Because there are other options nowadays. There are so many options that they can pursue. But they decide to be in animal sciences, and the reason is because they like to work in this field. Whichever species, I know. I mean, I work with small and the large ruminants, but we have undergrads interested in swine nutrition, poultry nutrition, equine nutrition. But whichever students I interact with, they are very, very excited about working in animal sciences, getting more hands-on experience, and knowing more and more about animal sciences background. So I think that sets them apart for success. If they are in the field and they are passionate about what they do, I think nothing can stop them, basically, because there will be challenges, right? I mean, we all face challenges, but if you are excited about achieving something, you can overcome those challenges. And I see that in our both graduate and undergraduate students. I think one of the attributes that is really important for both students, undergrads and grads, is the troubleshooting skills. Because no matter which sector we work in, right? I mean, I'm not talking about animal sciences. You just name it, whatever sector it is. I think those students who think about solutions then just focusing on the problems will have greater chances of success later on. You know, we all face challenges, and some of us maybe are stuck on the problems, and there are others who think about solutions and overcome those challenges. And I think you were talking about an attribute that, you know, that is important for our students. I think this is the attribute that is needed, how to overcome challenges and how to troubleshoot every spot. So focusing on the solutions instead of the problems. And I think that set students apart, and regardless of which sector they are in, it ensures success.
Yeah, I think those are great answers. Passion and problem solving, right? Be passionate about what you're doing, and then be interested in the process of the problem solving. Every challenge is there's a solution to it, and be excited about going and trying to find that solution, right? Yeah, the journey on the problem solving journey is kind of the fun part once you approach it with that mindset. The last question that I had then is, and this could be actually something in your field, or it could be something kind of more just related to, you know, overall knowledge management, whatever it is. But for those that are listening to the podcast or watching on YouTube, if you could pick one resource, you know, off of something that, you know, could be something online, or it could be a book off your shelf or something that is, if you could pick one resource to share with people watching or listening that you think, well, they may not know about this one, but it's been really impactful for me, or I've found it really valuable. Does anything come to mind?
So I like reading books, both books in my field and the field outside. And my favorite are reading autobiographies and some of the self-help books, because that helps me figure out how things should be done in a much more efficient way. So if someone is listening, a student is listening, and would like to really bring something that makes their work culture much more efficient, the one book that I really prefer is Atomic Habits. Mm-hmm. This is a book where it goes through stepwise ways and how we can make what we do in a much more efficient way without making it very stressful for us. So that is outside of animal sciences. But in the animal sciences, if someone is interested in nutrition, the book that really sparked my interest was a book by Van Soest. I think a Nutrition Ecology of Ruminants. I hope the title is correct, but that is the book that was published long back. But, if someone is interested in nutrition, in pursuing career as a nutritionist, that is a starting point when you start thinking about the importance of the nutrition, and then everything else follows. So, these are the two books I would highly, highly encourage. And yeah, I mean, there are a lot of resources nowadays as well. They can always go to other resources.
Yeah, no, those are great. We always like, suggestions, especially, novel new ones. We're kind of try to build out that potential library. I write them down every time we do this. And every time I listen to one of our other hosts do one, I write them down, and it kind of gets added to a someday reading list for those few times as a faculty member where I get to read what I want instead of read what I have to as it goes. Well, I've really enjoyed our conversation today. Again, my guest has been Dr. DeWalker Vias. He is an associate professor at the University of Florida in the Department of Animal Science. Thanks for the conversation today. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you very much, Adam, for having me. Really appreciate it. I also enjoyed our conversation. It was really good.
Again, I'm Adam Farenholz from North Carolina State University. On behalf of WiseNetics, this has been the Feed Science Podcast. Feel free to like and review and let us know what you think about the podcast and all the other podcasts on the WiseNetics Network. And we will talk to you the next time.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without the time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on more $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.